Welcome to the Personal Computer Show. Today is Wednesday, March the 25th, 2020. This is day 10 of the 15-day shutdown order to stay at home. We have a medical COVID-19 pandemic crisis. Take heed of the guidelines issued by the government. This is serious. I'm Hank Key and my colleague is Joe King. Our website is pcradioshow.org. And we are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on PRN.fm, streaming on the Internet. Podcasts of the programs available on PRN.fm, on the Internet, and PCRadioShow.org. U.S. students are being asked to work remotely, but 22% of homes don't have Internet. Bothell High was one of the first schools to close mere days before a man in the neighboring city of Kirkland, Washington, became the first U.S. patient to pass away due to COVID-19. Then the entire North Shore School District announced it would close its doors for up to 2 weeks, planning to transition schoolwork from classroom to cloud for online learning. What has followed has been a rash of thousands of school closures across the nation, district by district, state by state, university by university. More than half of the country's students have been sent home to prevent the spread of disease and instructed to continue their education via video chats and message boards. But what about students who don't have broadband at home? But nationwide, approximately 22% of households don't have home internet, including more than 4 million households with school-aged children. Poor families and people of color are particularly impacted. Only 56% of households making less than $20,000 have home broadband, and Black and Hispanic households lag behind their white counterparts. Even among students who theoretically have access, not all access are equal. According to census research, 8% of households who have internet rely exclusively on mobile broadband. Once again, low-income people and communities of color are disproportionately more likely to be mobile-only broadband adopters. This also has particular impact on students. Only about half of school-age children who live in mobile-only households personally use the internet at home, perhaps because of the difficulty of sharing mobile devices. And while it is better than being completely disconnected, mobile-only access isn't ideal. Mobile services are often limited by data caps, and mobile devices can make certain tasks incredibly challenging. Imagine studying for your calculus exam or writing a world history paper on a cell phone. This is a reality for a lot of students who don't have home broadband. Despite what you hear from some folks in Congress, the digital divide isn't just about rural communities or people who don't adopt broadband because they just don't get it. In fact, study after study shows that people don't have internet because they can't afford it, and because systemic racial discrimination blocks them from subscribing. When schools move online, poor students and kids of color fall behind. This compounds generations of systemic racial and economic inequities. Some schools are trying to bridge the gap. North Shore School District, for example, has offered loans of 4,000 computers and 600 internet hotspots to students who need them. But many schools don't have the resources to do so, and others are wrestling with even deeper inequities. New York officials called closing schools a last resort because of the disparate impacts it would have on poor students without internet and other resources. Most at risk are the 114,000 unhoused students in the district who depend on school lunches and breakfast programs for reliable meals and school nurses for health care. These digital and civil injustices existed long before COVID-19, but the need for social distancing in the face of a pandemic has thrown them into a sharp relief. Who can keep up with their schoolwork? Whose parents have time and resources to take on the role of monitoring their kids throughout the day? Whose family can spare a dedicated device for each student? While students and their families grapple with this sudden dramatic shift to online learning, policymakers and internet service providers must act. Free Press has called on all internet service providers to suspend data caps and overage fees, pause service disconnections, expand low-cost services, and even to waive billing for those hardest hit by the novel coronavirus and the social distancing required to contain it. Some ISP are taking up the cause, but there's still much more that companies and policymakers can and should do to bridge the digital divide in this moment of crisis. We need public policies that bring real price competition to ensure universally affordable broadband access. April 15th is the federal tax filing deadline, but it has been extended to July 15th. All taxpayers and businesses will have this additional time to file and make payments without interest or penalties. The IRS had deferred the payment deadline to July 15, but had left the April 15 filing deadline in place. The federal government moved tax day from April 15 to July 15 in response to the coronavirus pandemic, granting more time for both filing and payment. But for many taxpayers, it might not matter much if states don't follow suit, and right now only some have done so. If you're getting a refund, experts suggest still filing as soon as possible. You would be so lucky if you owe money. It means you have had use of government money interest-free. If it had been completed and a refund is expected, don't wait. It's your money. If you owe money, you can wait till July 15, and in the meantime have had use of government money interest-free. States should follow federal lead in postponing tax day, but not all states have the same deadline date as for the federal return. Check your respective state deadline. It may not have been changed or posted. Not all states have extended deadline date. Unfortunately, most states are currently on track to require the tax returns be filed by April 15. States which do not extend their own filing deadline to July 15 will negate much of the benefit of the federal extension because taxpayers would still have to prepare much of the relevant tax information. A great deal of it is drawn from their federal 1040s by the earlier date. Although most states follow the normal federal April 15 date as a deadline for annual filers, this tends to be a statutory date, not a direct linkage with the federal government's deadline. Even with a federal filing deadline delay, states will still require filers to submit their returns by April 15, unless policymakers act because the new federal extension falls after every state regular filing deadline. Several states have already announced revised filing guidance given the coronavirus crisis, but most have not. To the extent that states have the flexibility to avoid automatic budget reductions, should collection be pushed into the next fiscal year, they should try to follow the federal government July 15 deadline. Revenue officials in other states have indicated they are monitoring the situation and may act soon, and many states have already announced additional flexibility for businesses and individuals who owe the taxes with imminent filing deadlines. Although tax deadlines tend to be statutory, revenue departments or governors are frequently empowered to postpone them, particularly when an emergency declaration is in place in some states. However, legislative action may prove necessary to provide taxpayers with deadline relief. Now that the federal decision is known, states should take immediate steps to postpone to July 15, if possible, avoiding a burden to their own taxpayers that the federal extension was intended to relieve. Windows 10 updates could now slow down your PC. Several recent Windows 10 updates are seriously impacting the speeds of PCs that they were installed on. Windows 10 updates KB453-5996, KB454-0673, and KB455-1762 could all make your PC slower to boot. I'll repeat those three knowledge base updates. KB453-5996, KB454-0673, and KB455-1762. Not only are these updates making PCs slower to boot, when Windows 10 does load up, some people have noticed that their computers act more slowly than before. For example, taking longer to load up apps on open folders. Not everyone will be affected by these issues. The KB4551762 update, which is for people running Windows 10 19.03 and 19.09 versions, the two latest major Windows 10 releases, is causing people to notice abnormal processor and disk usage, which can seriously impact the performance on the computer. KB4551762 is billed as an important update that is supposed to bring a number of fixes. That means Windows 10 users are being encouraged to install it. However, there are complaints about issues their PCs are having after installing the update, including slow boot times, system crashes, and the dreaded blue screen of death. Some people are also stating that the update itself fails to install, instead throwing up an error message. This might be a blessing in disguise. How to fix these problems? The easiest way of fixing the problems they have brought is to uninstall the updates themselves. Once uninstalled, the users have reported that the issues have cleared up. If there are any issues with the uninstall process, you can elect to do a system restore to the system status in 2018. I was asked, what if I had not yet updated Windows 10 to builds 19.03 or 19.09? If everything is running fine, let's say nothing is broken, well, hold off on it. You can wait. We will post on our website, pcradioshow.org, how to uninstall these three Windows updates. All the free streaming services that just might be what you're looking for. Many of us right now are spending more time at home than we really want to, but we have to right now. We're hunkered down as we shelter in place or limit the amount of time we traditionally spend outside of our homes. And there's a good chance we may be turning to our streaming services to keep ourselves occupied. Nielsen estimates that staying inside can lead to a nearly 60% increase in the amount of content consumers watch. But if you're like me, you may already have exhausted the good stuff worth watching on your regular go-to services. Before you pony up for yet another service to go through, consider any of a number of free services at your disposal. And there's a lot. Some are Disney Plus and Apple TV Plus. They offer a year for free to Verizon customers and users of new Apple devices, respectively. Many popular platforms offer free trials that can range from anywhere between 7 days to 3 months, as in the case for the soon-to-launch mobile service called Quibi, Q-U-I-B-I. Others are always free, and they may just be what you need to switch up your options. Whatever you need, Gizmodo has compiled a lengthy, but no way complete list of options to keep you busy. There is Sling TV. For you live TV diehards, Sling TV is a service that offers live programming on the super cheap with a ton of customization and bundle options. Sling TV typically starts at around $30 a month, but the service has introduced a free ad-supported version of its service that includes free movies and TV as well as ABC News Live and local Fox affiliates in 18 cities that include New York, Philadelphia, Chicago, Detroit, District of Columbia, Atlanta, Houston, Seattle, Los Angeles, and San Francisco. It's available on Chrome, Safari, Edge, and through apps on Roku, Amazon, or Android devices. This Canopy, that's K-A-N-O-P-Y, Canopy. It's a sleeper hit for high-quality free films and documentaries, typically with a focus on independent filmmaking, foreign films, and classic cinema, and Gizmodo named Canopy the best free streaming service you can subscribe to. But the catch is that it's not available everywhere, like New York City, unfortunately. The service is available through participating universities and libraries, so you'll either need a school login or library card to sign up. But if you can, definitely check it out. Canopy is available on iOS, Android, Android TV, Chromecast, Roku, Fire TV, and select smart TVs. Then there is CuriosityStream. This streaming service is another Gizmodo favorite, and you may have access to it for free if you're an Optimum or Suddenlink subscriber. CuriosityStream is a fantastic hub for documentaries and educational content, as well as originals. So this is a service to consider if you're maxed out on garbage television. Oops, my mistake. Not garbage television. Treasure television programs, and are looking for something a little more informative. If you're not a customer of either of those ISPs, CuriosityStream is very, very affordable, starting at just $3 a month or $20 for the whole year. The service is available on the web, Fire TV, Roku, Chromecast, Android, Android TV, iOS, Apple TV, Xbox One, and select smart TVs. And as I mentioned earlier, Disney Plus. Verizon customers who are on unlimited data plans or Fios can still snag a 12-month subscription to Disney Plus, the digital vault for all Disney catalog plus National Geographic, Marvel, Pixar, and Star Wars. It's also home to the first 30 seasons of The Simpsons. Disney Plus is fairly cheap too, at $7 a month after a 7-day free trial. But definitely give the trial a try if you haven't had a chance to yet. The service is available on Fire TV, Android TV, Apple TV, Chromecast, Roku, select smart TVs, Mac OS, PC, Chrome OS, Android, iOS, PS4, and Xbox One. And then there's Apple TV Plus. Apple TV Plus is another you have free access to if you recently purchased a new Apple product. The service is $5 per month, but you can binge its originals for free during a 7-day free trial. Apple TV Plus is available on the web, Apple devices, streaming platforms, and select smart TVs and AirPlay-enabled TVs. Then there's IMDb TV. This is often overlooked streaming service available on the web and Fire TV. Actually has a decent roster of free movies and series. Don't expect to see a ton of new releases. You probably have never seen some of these movies before. YouTube has plenty of free documentary content from channels like Vice or Frontline, documentaries from PBS, and you can subscribe to and build out a nice portfolio of free content. But YouTube also offers free ad-supported movies as well. Just head to the Movies and Shows tab and select Free to Watch. Be forewarned, the selections here isn't great, but you might find something of interest if you don't mind combing through the garbage. Whoops, there I go again. Combing through the treasured movies. And reader, there's a lot of it here. Vudu, V-U-D-U, a Walmart-owned service, actually has a good selection of content in its catalog of free, ad-supported movies, as with many other free services. You may have to dig a bit to find something of interest, but there's a solid mix of old and new to choose from. Vudu is available on the web, Roku, Chromecast, TiVo, PlayStation, Xbox One, NVIDIA, iOS, Android, and select smart TVs. And one that I started with was Pluto TV. Pluto TV is a good option for folks looking for a massive selection of live programming for free, as this service has more than 250 channels to surf. There's some on-demand content as well, which is great, but the service is ad-supported. And Pluto TV is available on Fire TV, Android, Chromecast, iOS, PlayStation, Roku, and select smart TVs. And there's Tubi, or Tubi. Well, it's spelled T-U-B-I. Tubi is a stellar ad-supported service with a ton of quality movie and series. Again, it's ad-supported with breaks every 12 to 15 minutes, so this won't be a service for someone who minds interruptions. But overall, it's a great service if you're just looking for something to put on. And a favorite of many of readers, Tubi is available on Roku, Apple TV, Fire, Fire TV, Xbox, Chromecast, TiVo, Android, Xfinity, X1, and Cox Contour. Well, just remember, many of them are trials, and if you just try the trials and get out of it, it's all free. But be careful. Keep in mind that most major streaming services have trials that run anywhere from a week to even months. Quibi, which launches April 6, is currently offering a 3-month free trial to users who pre-order the app. Streaming giants like Hulu, HBO, YouTube TV, and Netflix all offer free 7-day trials as well. If you're not currently a subscriber, CBS All Access is also a trial to consider, as it's got great originals like Star Trek and The Twilight Zone. And hopefully by that time, and the 15-day period of the national emergency where we are to stay at home will have ended and we can turn off the TV. Presenting Benjamin Rockwell with his IT Pro Series and featuring part 5 of 5, Why IT Business Culture.
This is Benjamin Rockwell, and now is time for covering professional information technology topics. Here, I give you experience from my 30 years of being an IT professional. This is part 5 of 5 in regards to why businesses need information technology, whether it's a single person, as a consultant from outside, a single employee inside, or an entire department. For some of you, this will be insight. Others, a reminder. Still more may hear me voice some of the different experiences I've had along the way, some of the different thoughts I've had, and maybe it'll make you think just slightly differently. I do want you to know that you can reach me here at the show. Just write to me. I will get back with you. Now, we've talked about these different topics, and I've made references a number of times here to various quotes. They actually all came from one person. They all came from one particular boss that I dealt with over the years. And yes, he did ask me at one point, why do we need a website? Why do we need internet access? Why do we need to do statistical analysis and different reports? Why do we need to follow these reports? Why do we need to do this, that, or the other thing? Why do we need backups? Why do we need passwords? Why do you really insist on increasing the security at our company? Nobody wants to know what we do. And every time he turned around, I had an answer for him. And sometimes those answers, they satisfied him. And sometimes they didn't, until later on when he found out that I was right. That's always kind of uncomfortable, especially when, you know, he didn't take that very well. He didn't like correction. But that's another story for another day. So, yes, we've talked about communication with customers, reaching out via the email and internet website, but also utilizing the internet and the research abilities of the internet. We also have talked about the efficiencies within a company, and we've talked about the security. Now, I want to point out that throughout the time that I worked for him, he slowly changed his ideas of technology and what it could do for him. Ironically, he had a background in information technology as far as he got his degree in managemental information systems. Yeah, I would have thought he was well prepared and had the answers to all of these things. Maybe he was testing me at times. I don't know. But I will tell you that at one point in time, his thought process shifted and changed. So he was no longer dismissing technology, no longer dismissing that nerd over there. Instead, he talked about some of the different technology items that the company was doing. He talked about the different business culture approaches that we were doing to improve our customer relations, to improve our efficiency, to improve the business in general. He then went on to sell the company, and he made a good amount of money. Part of that sale was based on, yes, the technology involved at the company. Technology can be used in so many different ways to benefit your company. Whether we're talking about communication, We're talking about just the different business culture of encouraging usage of technology for research, for improving the company, just changing the way things work. If I talk to you and I say, yeah, we don't have a computer system, what do you think about our company? If your employees are all sitting around and they're saying, yeah, we've got these old, really bad computers, these things, they're still running Windows XP here. What do you think they think about the company? Now, instead, the company has high technology items. They've got a number of different things, and they show that, yeah, we've got a lot of high technology, but we can afford it because we're paying everybody really well, and we're doing really well as a business. Well, that's a different kind of a feeling that people have. There's a different level of morale for someone who has a computer that boots up in a matter of 20 seconds instead of 20 minutes. And that's all revolved around that last item, which is building your business culture of being a more technologically savvy company. Additionally, when you do this, you can also develop an atmosphere of communication, a communication that breaks down some of those social barriers, that moves information faster. There are companies out there which encourage people to communicate electronically because, yes, you can handle a number of different things very quickly. But people these days are very reluctant to pick up the phone and just chat with a coworker. Today, we have the ability to reach out electronically and chat with a matter of 10, 15, 20 people all at the same time. Some in different chat windows than others, or different email threads, and we're able to move information around. We also get to kind of relax because we're utilizing something that we're already familiar with. I'll tell you, we're all very familiar with information technology in the form of Facebook, in the form of sending our personal emails, in the form of all of the different chats that we do. There was a company I worked for that we had a software package, and the next release of that software package was moving our ERP software, Enterprise Resource Planning software, into a kind of social media approach. A matter of where you would ask plain English questions via the ERP software to other people. How soon can we get these five widgets done? And they could say, we'll have this ready for you by the end of the day. Wow. Just like Facebook. Kind of cool, huh? Yes, you definitely need information technology in the workplace. This is Benjamin Rockwell. Back to you, Hank.
Thank you, Benjamin. The coronavirus will change the world permanently on how we communicate with each other. The virus has kept many of us contained in our homes, maybe for months. With the use of the internet, we have already reoriented our relationship to government, to the outside world, and even to each other. During the coronavirus pandemic crisis, access to the high-speed internet is a lifesaver that millions lack. We have Americans, mostly in rural and poor households, for whom staying home is devastating because they have no broadband access. The situation is putting a spotlight on what needs to be done, urgently, to close the digital divide. The need to be connected is no longer a privilege, it's a necessity. Vulnerable and rural populations are disproportionately affected by the lack of connectivity. Right now, 45% of low-income families and approximately a quarter of rural communities do not have access to broadband. Large number of students have been asked to stay at home to further contain the spread of the virus. With a disproportionate number of school-age children lacking home broadband access, the breadth of the U.S. digital divide has been revealed as schools struggle to substitute in-school resources with online instruction, electronic libraries, streaming videos, and other online tutorials. In the span of roughly 2 weeks, the American higher education system has been transformed. Its future is increasingly uncertain. Most classes are now being held online, often with the rest of the semester. Dorms are emptying across the country. Some universities are even postponing or canceling graduation ceremonies scheduled months out. This is all the more surprising given most universities have a reputation for being reticent to change, especially in a short amount of time. Colleges have tried to react quickly to enact measures that would help to stop the virus spread. On America's campuses, professors and students, many of them international, work in close proximity for long periods of time. Dorm rooms are often shared between multiple individuals, making social distancing next to impossible. All of those changes could threaten colleges' existence. Parents and students are demanding refunds for shortened semesters in the dorm. The value and quality of an elite college education is under scrutiny as universities pivot to makeshift online classes. And it's unclear how students will view colleges once the crisis is over and they're welcomed back on the campuses. With the invention of the personal computer, people predicted that our jobs would eventually be emancipated from the office, and home would be the thrilling future of work. According to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, only 29% of Americans can work from home, including 1 in 20 service workers and more than half of information workers. The coronavirus outbreak has triggered an anxious trial run for remote work at a grand scale. What we learn in the next few months could help shape a future of work that might have been inevitable with or without a once-in-a-life-century public health crisis. Even before the pandemic struck, remote work was accelerating in the United States. The share of the labor force that works from home tripled in the past 15 years, according to the Federal Reserve. Two of the accelerants are obvious: living costs in metros with the highest density of knowledge workers and technology remote workers impede the creative sparks that fly when we are interacting with actual people. Employees work more, quit less, and said they were happier with their job. Meanwhile, the company saved more than $1,000 per employee on reduced office space. But one common complaint transcends everything else: loneliness. Companies will have to normalize more video conferencing and corporate retreats because the employees will continue to crave face-to-face interaction. Despite increasing numbers of older adults accessing the internet and many recent retirees having used computers during their careers, the digital divide between older adults and younger people still exists. Older adults use significantly fewer digital applications and spend less time online than younger adults. Following interviews with older adults, researchers have discovered that resistance to using digital technology is not primarily rooted in access issues, as widely believed. Researchers found that personally held values to do with the desirability of technology, wider concerns regarding its impact on society, and fears of getting things wrong when using software are also significant factors holding back technology use among older adults. Some older people are put off using online tools because they see them as being arduous and time-consuming. They feel that the trend towards online services, such as comparison websites, places a greater burden on themselves to become experts in all manner of things, whereas previously one could ask and seek out trained professionals to assist with decision-making. And security concerns were omnipresent among the older adults interviewed, with many of them lacking confidence in their own knowledge of how to use online tools properly, in particular, online banking. A strong sense of social responsibility may be a more important factor underlying many older people's rejection of digital technology. They worry that online shopping takes business from local shops, threatening the town centers in which they can socialize with their friends. They also worry that if they don't go into the bank or the post office, they may close and people may lose their jobs. The fact that digital technologies can and do make certain jobs obsolete is a common concern for older adults who worry about their grandchildren's job prospects. Developing solutions to attend to this wider societal problem appears to be the key to fostering acceptance of digital technologies among older adults. Social isolation is another concern. Some older people are rejecting online shopping as they welcome the social benefits of daily face-to-face contact when shopping in person. In many cases, making digital technologies appealing for older adults means ensuring that digital engagements do not replace social interactions, and if possible, facilitate new social and community building opportunities where they can meet people. 70% of seniors today are now online. Young people may roll their eyes at older people who can't use technology as fast as they do, but it's wrong to say that old Americans can't use technology. Middle-aged and older adults are embracing technology for a variety of reasons. Recent national data reveals that Americans are more digitally connected than ever before, with approximately 70% of seniors now connected to the internet. These devices are a part of their daily lives to stay informed, connect to friends and family, shop, make travel plans, and make reservations for travel and transportation. Apps such as MetaSafe, Google Maps, with parking spot reminders, HomeAway, Luminosity are also becoming among the older population. The march toward an ever-aging society underscores a major demographic and technological shift. The well-being of many aging boomers will increasingly depend upon technology. The number of caregivers in the job market is not expected to keep pace with those who want and need help for older adults aging in place. By 2050, the potential ratio of caregivers to those needing care in the high-risk 80-plus age group will drop to 3-to-1, revealing a mismatch between care needs and care providers. But few seniors and even developers of software and tech devices understand what this trend may mean in terms of costs and benefits. Privacy and security and equity of care, especially for those living in rural and low-income urban areas. A recent report from the National Science and Technology Council addresses many of these issues by acknowledging four important facts about technology adoption. Cost factors. In comparison to the benefit of technology, in addition to concern over form factors such as screen and keyboard size, many older adults fail to see the added benefits for the cost of smartphones. Seniors often prefer the lower costs, prefer form factors such as large, bright displays, or durable construction and longer battery life. Flip phones, as compared to the average price of $800 for a smartphone, which may require a headset and daily and if not more frequent charging. Mobile apps require updates and relearning of operations. App vendors frequently update their products, sometimes add features, but also to fix bugs and close security holes. Nearly 50% of older adults 65 and older and 40% of those aged 50 to 64 feel they need someone to assist them in learning and using a new technology device as compared to approximately 20% of those ages 18 to 29. Security and privacy threats fuel the fears of technology. Older adults have concerns about new technology's potential to disrupt their privacy and the potential for invasion of personal and financial security. And finally, the last factor, age. Educational level and economics are primary drivers of adoption. While the desire for aging in place cuts across demographic groups, internet use and technology adoption are largely driven by the financial and educational acumen of older adult adopters. Younger, relatively affluent or more highly educated seniors are driving much of the recent growth in tech adoption. Despite these concerns, older Americans who use the internet tend to view technology in a positive light and are likely to increasingly incorporate digital and voice-activated technology into their daily lives. According to the Pew Research, tech adoption among older adults, fully 58% of adults ages 65 and older, say technology has had a mostly positive impact on society, while roughly three-quarters of internet-using seniors say they go online on a daily basis, and nearly 1 in 10 go online almost constantly. And yet, while some older people are savvy tech users, many face unique age-related physical and cognitive challenges that may act as barriers to being fully engaged in an increasing digital world. Declines in visual clarity make reading small font on smartphone screens challenging. Color vision also diminishes with age, and older users may have difficulty distinguishing colors and need higher levels of contrast between colors. If a smartphone or a smartwatch interface relies on colors as user guides from one feature to another, older adults may face challenges. And age-related hearing loss is common for adults over 65. As a result, older users may fail to hear alerts and soft high-pitched pings that a device or app uses to announce upcoming calendar events, push notifications, or alarms. Hand-eye coordination may also make using small devices difficult. Finger swiping on the screen comes naturally to younger adults raised with electronics in their hands. Not so much for older adults. What forces will propel more attention to technological solutions for addressing the needs of older persons? Certainly, it's the sheer numbers of projected older adults worldwide and a recognition that technology will be needed to help maintain older people's health and independence given the shrinking population of available caregivers. Our aging population, which represents both opportunities and challenges, is a compelling business opportunity for the private sector, particularly among companies urgently trying to find how technology can best support older adults. The economic power of older adults is a secret in plain sight, and the corporate community is just beginning to appreciate why academic institutions are investing in learning more about aging. Public health and aging researchers are creating the fact base for the 21st century entrepreneurs to think strategically to overcome age stereotypes. For maximum benefit, technology must be responsive to new generations of older adults who are aging in place with more investment and interest in new technology. We can best accomplish this by developing an inclusive policy and public framework for the use of digital devices, social networks, AI, and robotics that enable older adults to connect, create, and contribute in their golden years. And as Obi-Wan Kenobi told us in Return of the Jedi, you're going to find that many of the truths that we cling to depend greatly on our own point of view. Presenting Marty Winston with All Hands on Tech. Airlocks for Houses.
I defied all the bans. I went to the office anyway. It was fine. I was the only one there. Besides, I work from a home office. I'm always the only one there. And home is where the heart is this week. Not just home. This can also apply to almost any building as we start by imagining what might change if every doorway could qualify as an airlock. You've heard the term before, airlock. In reality, as in fiction, an airlock is a chamber between inside and outside that doesn't let the doors to both be open at the same time. Most people think of an airlock as something you only need on a spaceship, or maybe a submarine, where what's outside is, if not completely unsurvivable, at least hostile to the odds of assured survival. But what if we could relax that a little bit? What if we could have seals that aren't completely pressure seals? You know, some houses already have informal airlocks, things like a front door vestibule or a back entry mudroom. In each case, the air in there is a little different from the air outside or the air inside, and that's the whole point of thinking about this. The more that the indoors can be completely shielded, fully insulated against casual air exchanges with the air outdoors, the more effective those in-between places can be in their roles as informal airlocks. Now, by now, you might worry that this whole segment will just deal with some sort of theoretical what-if question, and that's not where we're going. You'll hear some very practical suggestions before we're done. Some of the same things that can help make a house more livable can also make life itself more livable by reducing your vulnerability to respiratory infections. A broad slate of them. And by helping reduce their impact if you do end up getting one. The last thing you want to hear is a lecture or a list of things to do without some grounding, some reason for doing them, some explanations of what they're about and enough information, well, to make it more than reasonable for you to make your own decisions about what to do or not to do. So please hang on for the ride. And let's get back to the idea of airlocks. We're only about a minute away from explaining what's so threatening about the air outside. Maybe nothing, depending on where you live, or maybe a lot you never much thought about. We'll get there, even if we have to get there through airlocks. In fact, this is the point where the subject gets more interesting. If you're fortunate enough to live in a well-insulated, energy-efficient house, you've already gone a long way to avoiding, even blocking, exchanges between the indoor air you need to breathe and the outdoor air it may be a bad idea to breathe. Or you may have overdone it. If the indoor air gets too stale, or if there's not enough oxygen in it, or if some of the unfriendly indoor gases have been filling up the place, it may be smart to add a forced air exchange appliance to your ventilation system. They blow the stagnant air out and let a limited amount of fresh air in. Well, maybe not so fresh air. It's outdoor air, but what's really in it? So, a related question. Did your mom or anyone ever serve stew? What was in it? Some kind of meat? Veggies? What else? Unless every serving of stew you ever eat always comes out of a Dinty Moore can, the odds are that no two servings of stew are ever quite the same. They can have a lot of ingredients in common, and maybe from time to time a few oddballs, and while it's all stew, it's also always a little different. And air is like that too. The air we breathe is its own kind of stew. It's not just the oxygen and nitrogen and carbon dioxide that got the spotlight in grade school. It's not just the pollen count. It's not just the pollution warnings. It's not just the bouquets of aromas of paint and fertilizer and standing water and cooking and insect spray. It's not just dust blown by the winds or the coughs and sneezes of sick neighbors, which is why it's helpful to think of separating the air indoors from the air outdoors. Indoors, even if nothing else ever happens, there's breathing. People and pets, cats, dogs, ferrets, lizards, goldfish, ant farms, and all those living things breathing are constantly reducing the level of oxygen in the stew recipe for indoor air and increasing the level of carbon dioxide. Plants constantly draw down the carbon dioxide and increase the oxygen. Flames from gas stoves or gas furnaces or gas dryers or candles, flames reduce the level of oxygen and increase the levels of both carbon dioxide and carbon monoxide. But listen, you don't have to be a forensic chemist and worry about these things in a lot of detail. Outdoors, though, that's something else again. Are you close to a street? How busy a street? Are there any factories in your neighborhood? How close is the nearest major traffic artery? Internal combustion engines and many factory processes generate carbon monoxide, ozone, nitrogen dioxide, and tiny particles of micro soot. Put them all together and they spell air pollution. You no more want those things in your house than you want to move your bed into the garage and sleep with the car's engine running. You can look up my segment in the show archives on indoor air quality. Since I got the Yoohoo, that's U-H-O-O, since I got the Yoohoo InfraReview, it lets me track 9 ingredients in that air stew. By now, the idea of an airlock sounds just a little less bizarre, a little more attractive. But what is it that an airlock really controls, really limits? The official answer? It's something called an exchange product, which is what you get when you multiply the area of a doorway times the duration that it's open. It's a measure of how freely outside air can flow inside, or vice versa. Happily, an airlock isn't the only way to address that exchange, but before we get to that, we have one very important piece left to cover. Why? What's really the motivation? What's relevant about this right now? It comes down to this. The more irritants you inhale when indoors, the more vulnerable you are to respiratory infections. Air pollution is corrosive, and even a whisper of a whiff coming in with every breath can make everybody at your address a little more susceptible to all kinds of infections, colds, flu, bronchitis, pneumonia, COVID-19, you name it. By the way, getting any of those, or even just an allergy attack, can increase your susceptibility. So, yeah, do what you can to mimic an airlock with your existing doors and habits. But here are some other measures you may want to consider that can also help civilize the recipe for that stew of air you've been breathing. One way is to let technology help cleanse the air in your house. Change your filters. That starts with you figuring out where they all are and writing down everything you need to know to be able to buy replacements. These days, it can also be a good idea to get those replacements delivered. You can also be even more aggressive and add some additional air cleaning with ionic or electrostatic or HEPA-filtered room air purifiers. And think about whole house electrostatic air cleaning. Dryness is another source of irritation that can make you more vulnerable to infection. So a whole house humidifier is a good idea. Ideally, a steam humidifier, or use room humidifiers. There are three kinds: ultrasonic, cool mist, and hot mist. Ultrasonic humidifiers tend to create a lot of white dust. Cool mist always worked well for us. You can also create something that works a little like an airlock outside your house by planting greens, especially shrubbery and trees. Deciduous trees with broad leaves work very well and don't plague their surroundings with all that pine pollen, which is always reminiscent of powdered paint. You're unlikely to have enough plants to totally neutralize the impact of surrounding pollution, but they're a huge help. One more important note. When it comes to inhaled infections, your body has a built-in bouncer that your own personal habits may be bypassing. It's your white blood cells, already deployed inside your nostrils where the mucous membrane there mount those white blood cells to the filtering forest of small hairs up inside your nose. When you breathe through your nose, they can work against both incoming and outgoing airborne infections. But a lot of people let those infections slide right by all that and take a back door into the body through mouth breathing. I found something helpful. I got it to help me cut down on my snoring, but it just plain opens up my nostrils to make nose breathing a path of least resistance. It's a flexible twin arch insert that I slide up into my nose from Z Quiet, the letter Z like the Z's in cartoon snoring, and the word quiet, the Z Quiet Breathe. You may want to read up on it. One more thought. In a critical circumstance, when you want to avoid directly inhaling the air but masks aren't available, you can cobble together an effective substitute using elastic bands and a coffee filter. Well, now that we've aired all that out, can you guess what I'm springing on you next time? It's time to talk about spring cleaning. No, it's not April Fool's really going to do it. I'd say that it's an evergreen topic, but then we'd end up spending too much time on pine pollen. We will talk about a lot of the surfaces you touch, tech as well as not, that need, these days, to be not just cleaned, but disinfected. So join me next time for what isn't quite an episode of The Untouchables.
Thank you, Marty. Public service announcements. A 15-day shutdown stay-at-home order was issued by the government due to the COVID-19 pandemic crisis. All scheduled computer club meetings have been canceled. Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.fm, streaming on the Internet. Podcasts of the program is available on prn.fm, on the Internet, and pcradioshow.org. If you have any questions for us, just send us an email addressed to hank@pcradioshow.org. In the meantime, stay in touch and remember to do regular backups. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Joe King, Michael Horowitz, Marty Winston, and Benjamin Rockwell, we thank you for listening. Stay safe and healthy. Until we meet again, same time, same station, next week.